Good afternoon. This is Chelan County Public Utility District Commission special meeting with legislative representatives from our district on December 12th, 1 p.m. If I seem a little bit disoriented, it's because I haven't got some things written out here that usually are written here to remind me, but that's all right. We're happy to have everybody here. This meeting, the sole purpose of this meeting is to talk about upcoming legislative session and have give our representatives and representative-elects opportunity to make a few comments. But we normally, in our commission meetings, start with a flag salute and a safety minute. And today, I will lead the flag salute, and the flag is over there, and then Ron Franklin will give us a safety minute. So please rise.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Hi, I'm Ron Franklin, Director of Safety and Health at the district. Safety minute's one that we've used many times before, and we've tried to keep it topical, but that's winter driving conditions. And as most of you know, we live in an area that is frequently impacted by weather and conditions, especially when you're trying to get over the pass. Looking at it a little bit, I was surprised that the 70% of the nation, when it translates also, 70% of the population drives in areas considered impacted by snow. I thought that was, I didn't think it was that much, but if you look at the map, it's 70%. Typical things also, you talk about safe driving tips, is there's obviously keeping your vehicle worthy for driving in snow, whether it be snow tires or windshield wipers. But the number one thing they find is they attribute the accidents to are people driving too fast for the conditions. And you've seen that before when you're driving over the pass and you've got somebody in a big lifted four-wheel drive doing about 65. I always think is, yeah, they go really well, but they don't stop any better or any faster than anybody else. So it's a false sense thinking that you can go really fast. Just the other day, as you know, in Blewett Pass, we had a head-on, sent people to the hospital, and the driver that crossed over the line was cited for too fast for the conditions again. So that's the kind of thing is you can be able to do everything you want to and being safe and drive, but you've always got to look out for the other guy. But slow down, give yourself plenty of time, and as you go through that, think of the worst case, what could happen, and what you need to do to prepare yourself for your travel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
So before I ask our electeds to give us a preview of what they see coming up in the session, just want to remind everybody in the room, and some people may not be aware, we record all of our meetings, and so speak into the mic, if you will, and just remember that there will be a permanent record of everything said here today. And with that, I would like to open with letting you know that Senator Parlett may or may not make it. She was installing new officers at the Republican Women's Luncheon today and said that she would be late at best. And since she was number one on our agenda, Senator-elect Brad Hawkins, we'd like to get some pearls of wisdom from you, what you see in your crystal ball for this upcoming session.
Well, first off, thanks for having us. Appreciate it. And it's always good to get together and talk about issues. I didn't bring too much to discuss today. Just as far as the upcoming legislative session, it's pretty much similar dynamics as prior sessions. So the House is in Democratic majority, and the Senate is in a majority coalition caucus. So it's a very thinly held majority in the Senate. And of course, Governor Inslee is returning. So some of the similar dynamics. We also have some of the carryover issues related to education and the Cleary decision. Budget will be a big topic. And there's always an adjustment with committees. Of course, with Representative-elect Mike Steele coming in, we're excited to have a new member of our legislative team. So Mike will do an awesome job. Not sure if Mike has his office figured out quite yet, but I did get assigned to my office. I just haven't been able to move in, but I'll be in Senator Honeyford's old office, which is in the Irv Newhouse building, which is sort of on the Capitol campus, but not in the legislative building itself. We went through committee assignments recently in the Senate, and I've been assigned three committees. The Agriculture and Water Committee, which will have a lot of issues that are important to our district, of course. Transportation, and Natural Resources and Parks. So three committees that I have an interest in and look forward to serving on. And always enjoy the visits from your commission and your colleagues. I think your staff does an awesome job, as you do as well. And so look forward to seeing you in Olympia again this year.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Representative Condotta, your crystal ball.
Well, thank you. Good to be here. Good to see you all here. Going to be an interesting session, as they always are. Challenging, for sure. The House is ready. We've got some great new members, including this one sitting next to me. I'm very excited to have Mike on board because he's been there, and he's going to hit the ground running. And we are going to assign our committees on Wednesday. We haven't done that yet, but we're going to try to get Mike into some great committees. And since I am the committee on committees with Dan Christensen, we should be able to get some good stuff going. I will be back on appropriations, back on finance on both sides of the budget. I'll be taking a more active role in the budget this year. And I will still remain on the Commerce Committee, which handles, as you know, pot, liquor, and gambling. So that's the Sin Committee. And that committee has actually got expanded quite a bit this year. So going to be, again, a challenge here. But the nice thing is, like last time, we have a significant amount of new revenue, about $3 billion over the 2 years. And we had that last time, and we were managed to navigate through the budget process. And I believe that's enough to get everything done. I don't see any reason for additional revenue at this point. I mean, you look in the last 4 years, we've gained $6 billion in additional revenue. The entire budget in Idaho is $8 billion for 2 years. So we're pretty well off. And Seattle is obviously booming. So I think we're in a good position to continue our work on education and also maybe fall back to some of the areas like Public Works Trust Fund and refill some of those buckets that have been, you know, borrowed from, so to speak. So I think a really positive session, and most of all, for what it's worth, I think the Donald Trump thing is huge. And Secretary of Interior, possibly Kathy McMorris, huge for us in the Northwest. So what I'm seeing at the federal level is the most encouraging thing I think I've seen since the Reagan era. And I think it's trickling down into our attitudes and the way our caucus feels. I know our members are really excited about next year. They feel really geared up and really positive that things are going more our way now. So, by the way, we did win those two seats I was after. Unfortunately, we lost two at the same time, so that didn't work out as well as we'd hoped. The Federal Way District swung 13 points to the Democrat side, which made it very difficult for two Republican incumbents to save their seats. We did everything we could, but we just came up a little short. But it is nice to know that we picked up the seat in the 19th, which is Aberdeen-Hoclium, for the first time since 1980. And we believe that's a trend in the outer areas. I think we rode the same wave that that President-elect Trump rode in terms of these blue-collar union areas that have been just totally depressed by the situation of no jobs, no factories, no forward movement. And I think that frustration came through for us and for him. And I think it's kind of a new wave that we can ride, and we hope that that'll get us those other two seats in a couple of years. We're already gearing up. We're ready to go. We're going to get there. So looking forward to working with all of you and hearing what you have to say.
Okay. Representative-elect Steele.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having us.
It's tough to call you that, Mike.
It's all right. It's all right. I'm still getting used to it myself. But it's great to be in front of all of you, and one of the things that I've already enjoyed about this new role is the time we've already spent getting familiar with a lot of the issues around the district. Folks have been very busy arranging pre-session meetings with all of us, so you're one of many groups that we're meeting with before we head over to Olympia, so that we can clearly understand your legislative priorities and that we can go to work on those things. As Carrie mentioned, we were in Olympia last week, I guess it was, and we spent some time for committee days there, and then also for me, new member orientation, getting kind of caught up to speed on the way the House works and being assigned a legislative office. Looks like tentatively I will be in the legislative building, so that'll be nice, right next door to where Brad's old office was, so you should be able to find me. So that's exciting. I have put in for several committees, and I'll get three of these, but appropriations, capital budget, tech and economic development, ag, and I think that's it. So a combination of those three will be assigned to me, and I think any one of those three will be really effective for the district, and that was kind of the goal as I went in for looking at those committee assignments. But I'm really excited about the possibilities for our district and all of the great work that people have already begun to do in preparation for session. There will be no shortage of long conversations and I think long evenings of debate around how we spend the state's money and the taxpayers' money, especially as it relates to education. So that will be the kind of the elephant in the room, if you will. And I think then once we solve the educational issues that face our state, we'll be able to focus on some other issues. So I know that there has already been a bill introduced or a pre-file, if you will, to fund education first. So we'll see how far that goes and what that really entails when we get to Olympia on the first day. So being sworn in.
Sorry, Mike. A bill to do what with education?
Fund education first.
I heard spun.
Yeah, fund education first.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll see where it goes. But again, it's going to be a priority, I think, of every legislator over there to work on this education issue, which will sort of overshadow, I think, most of the things we're talking about. But I'm excited to work with both of these gentlemen here and get some good things done for the 12th District. And one of the things you learn pretty quickly as a new member-elect is that you spend a lot of time listening and learning. And I'll be doing that in my first few days and weeks, probably, just to really be cognizant of what all those other folks with so much more experience have to teach me. But definitely going to be a strong voice for the district, and I look forward to it.
Super.
And if I could, I neglected to introduce my trusted legislative assistant, Blake Baldwin, and I know Representative Condotta's legislative assistant, Brant Capel, is here as well. We have hired an additional session aide. His name's Ryan Bay, and you'll get to know him when you make the trips over to Olympia. And we'll also have an intern in our Senate office assigned at some point. But for now, Cashmere's very own Blake Baldwin. And appreciate him being here and look forward to having you continue to work with him. As you know, the staff, you know, we just cannot accomplish anything in Olympia without our trusted staff. So excited to have Blake again this year.
Right. Thank you. Well, I know our staff, thinking about trusted staff, and we do trust our staff a lot, have a list of priorities that they would like to sort of go through, and I think to start off, Sean Seaman, who is no stranger to two of you for sure, and I don't know, Mike, if you know Sean at all, but...
We were just introduced, yes.
Okay. You'll get to know him fairly well this year. We'll cover a list of our priorities.
Thank you.
while he's passing that out, I might mention for Mike's benefit, during the first week of session, PUD Association always has a legislative reception in Olympia, and we will be definitely informing all of you of that.
Great.
And Sean might even mention that in his
Well, we'll make sure to get the invitation sent out to you so you know when it is and where it is, because they did change
new location. Yeah, I was going to point that out. New location.
Right.
Carrie's always there, so I thought I'd let him know.
Yeah, I'm glad you told me.
Well, I can tell you it's at the, well, it's not called the Red Lion anymore, but it's the old Red Lion.
The old Red Lion.
The old Westwater.
Oh, it goes even further back.
Oh my gosh, Randy goes way back.
It's like, remember the name of the grocery store in Leavenworth? How many different names has it been? So thank you very much. Again, my name is Sean Seaman. I'm with the External Affairs Department. As been mentioned, my primary role is work on state issues. And I'm looking forward to being there again this year, so we'll have an opportunity to see you all again, probably quite a few times, if not at least a handful of times. So today we're just going to go over what are our major policy areas and committees of interest. We're going to talk about overarching issues and then get into some specific issues of interest for UD as well. Not unusual for our list. It's pretty much the same list of our policy areas that we focus on. There's energy, of course, water, telecommunications, the environment, environmental. Glad to hear that there's a Mike, that you're going to be on the tech committee, you hope, as well, within the House. So that'd be good to see you there. And the PUD governor's operations areas, and then budget. We'll talk a little bit more about budget briefly, but those are just the overall areas that we tend to pay attention to. I managed to jump a screen ahead. Well, it seemed to be... Oh, we're good. I'm sorry. I apologize. Committees, again, you mentioned some of these, but these are generally the committees that we watch closely. We watch all bills, but these are the committees we tend to focus on while we're down there in Olympia. The overarching issues, budget, the Public Works Trust Fund was mentioned. Representative Condotta, thank you for your interest in that. It's an area we're working on with the Tri-Commission to ensure that it's an important source of funding for local governments within the county. We've used it in the past, and we want to do what we can to help sustain some kind of funding source for those projects. The Centennial Grant Fund, as you know, is out of the Department of Ecology. Steve will talk a little bit about this in more detail, but this is for a project we have in Peshaston to improve our wastewater treatment plant related to phosphorus removal to meet the state requirement for the river, the phosphorus in the river. Carbon is an area that we've been talking about now quite a bit in the last few years, and I think we'll continue to talk about that. We've seen in the past and anticipate there'll be some kind of cap and trade or invest type of legislation this year. Could be a response to the clean air rule that has passed. Rulemaking's going on. We'll watch that, but it could be something that comes forward through the legislature on that. The new proposals related to carbon, this could be in the form of a renewable portfolio standard, the RPS, as you may use the term, that's in the Energy Independence Act. Electrification of transportation, this could be as simple as, it's not simple as anybody working on it will know, but this could be electric vehicles, or it could be broader for that, depending on the audience. Representative Morris, we just wrote his singled him out. He held throughout the interim a monthly meetings of groups to try and develop the ideas and concepts around what could we do with carbon and energy. And we had hoped to see some introduction of bills from him prior to a session, but we haven't seen that yet. So we know we're anticipating bills from Representative Morris related to energy, could be carbon, solar, distribution planning, numerous issues with Representative Morris. The Senate bills. I can keep going on this.
Just a little inside joke.
Right. Senate bills, we saw some Senate bills last year related to carbon. We anticipate we'll see something come out of the Senate again. And then the I-937 post-2020 is the 2020 is the date where the Energy Independence Act doesn't sunset, but it comes to, there's some target dates there. And then what's after that at this point? The 15% renewable standard will be met. We'll continue to do cost-effective conservation, but what's beyond that? And so conversations have been taking place with post-2020 for quite a while, and what will we see this year? We'll be watching that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and he's going to give a little more details on our specific issues.
So I want to talk about two things. One is a big overarching set of principles that we're using to address carbon issues, because we know that that'll be a significant issue for this legislative session. And then we have 10 specific issues that we're tracking through the legislative process. So I'm going to walk through each one of those. Now, tomorrow you'll be meeting with the Tri-Commission, and there'll be an opportunity to list these issues as well. We'll probably be doing it quickly because every group will be talking about them. So I'm going to be pausing along the way, and I encourage you, if you have any issues or questions, please ask them, because today is a much better forum for being able to address those than tomorrow will be. On the carbon issues, you may recall that we have been pursuing this idea for a while of, is there a least cost path to address greenhouse gas emissions? So we're not trying to take a position on whether climate change should be addressed or not. We're just saying there's a lot of people out there talking about addressing it. If we're going to address it, then how would we do that in a least cost way? And we did that because for 30 years in the electric industry, we have been doing a lot of modeling work about what's the least cost way to meet load in a reliable fashion. So we said, well, we should be thinking about this carbon emissions issue in the same way that we think about meeting load. So we've done a study. I would say it's very limited in terms of, we only had a certain amount of money we could spend. We didn't spend very much money, to be honest. So, but we wanted to at least get our thinking organized around this. And we've developed a very preliminary supply curve for greenhouse gas emissions for the state of Washington. And as we look at that, we've said, okay, so we've got that, and then how would you compare that against the strategies you would adopt for the least cost path to meet load? And where is there a big overlap between those two? Because that's where we should focus first. And I think our frustration with this has been that we see lots of ideas thrown out there, and it's sort of this throw spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks strategy, as opposed to an analysis about what would be best for our economy and our environment. A least cost path to meeting greenhouse gas emissions and a least cost path to meeting load would be good for our economy and our environment. So we've We've finished that. We've talked about it with the Public Generating Pool and the Washington PUD Association, and have generated a lot of interest and support for the work that we've done there. I'll give you just a sense of kind of the key things. First of all, the two things that come right to the top of the list, they're really easy because they're at the top of the list for both meeting load and reducing carbon emissions, is energy efficiency and hydropower. So they are the least cost path for addressing both problems. So it would push you towards, well, what more can we do to support hydropower, and what more can we do to support energy efficiency? In the energy efficiency arena, it would even include things like new building standards. One of the things that we learned through doing this work is if you're trying to hit 2050 targets for greenhouse gas emissions, the actions you take today with respect to things like new buildings are incredibly important because those buildings are still there in 2050. Whereas the actions you take with respect to lighting, that may change out four or five times between now and 2050. So so basically we put together a set of things that we are now thinking through in the utility industry strategies around what more could we do with respect to hydropower and energy efficiency? What more could we do with these things where there's low building stock turnover, or low stock turnover, like buildings? We've also identified that with respect to things like renewables, non-hydro renewables, wind and solar are not least cost for meeting load in this region, at least for the next 20 years, nor are they least cost for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. On the other hand, if you're trying to hit these really aggressive 2050 targets, which are in state law, you need something more on the electric side, because you're probably going to have to electrify a number of sectors that are currently fossil fuel based, the biggest one being transportation. So there's some conundrums, actually. There's some places where actually there's some very difficult choices to be made. Am I trying to do least cost for the next 20 years? Am I focused on a 2050 target? So what this has helped us to do is just organize our thinking around different proposals. Sean just went through about a half dozen different things that we expect to come up in this legislative session. It's helping to guide us in terms of, so how would we react to each one of those as they come forward? For example, electric vehicles looks like a significant winner, potentially. Relatively low cost, but on the other hand, not for the utility industry. For society as a whole, a good deal, but not necessarily for the utility industry. So it helps us organize how would we think through electric vehicle policies. So you'll be hearing more from us on that over the course of the next couple of months. And we expect to hopefully have a number of allies in the utility community that will be working together on this. Okay. That was kind of big, I know, but any questions or thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think maybe, Steve, just a little addendum to that is that, regardless of where, people are on, whether it's climate change or et cetera, you can sit around and be the group of no, every time somebody comes up with an idea. So part of the philosophy of this is, a proactive stance to say, all right, if this is where it's going, let's find the best way to say yes, and cost-wise, et cetera. So I think that's, part of the philosophy behind it. So it's trying to build bridges and partnerships and move it forward in a way that's productive.
So. Good. Thank you. Next, I'm going to go through this page here, the 10 issues that we've identified. In general, they're not prioritized except for the first one, which is our highest priority. You may recall that we've been working on the TMDL issues in the Upper Valley for a long time. And you may recall that last year we were working on actions in both Peshastin and Dryden. When we got into more detailed design work on the Dryden project, the cost went up substantially. And it had worked out to a point at which it would cost in excess of about $80,000 per lot to do the work to be able to hit the TMDL standard. So we have pulled that from the proposal, and we're back having a conversation with the Department of Ecology about is there another way to be able to address this problem than what we've been looking at. The Peshastin fix does still look like it's an attractive one in order to move forward with. So the amount that we're seeking is lower than what we were looking at last year, which based on the feedback that we've gotten recently, there isn't that much money in this fund anyway, so hopefully we've given ourselves a better shot here. This is always identified as one of the highest priorities for the Department of Ecology. So we're looking at about a $2.5 million project, and we're looking for about $1.5 million in grant money. The 60% funding, which is the amount that for this type of project you would expect to qualify for.
So I'm just going to jump in here. We're being recorded, aren't we, Sheila? TMDL, total maximum daily load.
Yes.
And the primary issue of phosphorus.
Right.
Correct?
Thank you.
Yeah, just in case we've got people out there listening.
So you'll be hearing a lot from us on this one. We definitely would like to see this move forward. We're in a position to move forward. The design work is moving right along. We expect to be able to get this project going this year. We do have compliance requirements with the Department of Ecology as well that are coming up. We need to keep the project moving in order to meet our compliance requirements. So, again, it fits within state policy to move this forward. So we would literally like to see this one happen. Fuel mix disclosure. You may be aware that the Department of Commerce does a disclosure with respect to the amount of carbon that is a part of your system. So as an electric power supplier, they report on the amount of carbon that is part of your system. We don't think the calculation is done very well. For the most part, we have ignored it. There's some really significant problems with the way they define the amount of carbon on your system. They use certain ways of being able to define things where you purchase power, and they just put a fixed number on it that doesn't actually make sense for us. So we have been able to ignore it. I-732 would have used that as a way of defining your carbon content and consequently the cost associated with that. Obviously, 732 didn't make it, but it did cause us to think a lot over the course of the last 6 months about the risks of different types of carbon legislation coming forward and how it might use something like the fuel mix disclosure to create a cost for us. So we're engaged with the Department of Commerce about better ways to do that. We mainly wanted you to just be aware this fuel mix disclosure issue makes a big difference. And we think that when you're a hydro utility like us, it tends to create a bias against hydro utilities. And so we plan to be very active if there's any use of that, looking for different ways to be able to work with Commerce just to make sure that even if there isn't legislation, that the underlying methodology gets right so that we don't have the wrong kind of reporting going on. Any questions on that? Distributed generation. So you've seen distributed generation bills a number of times over the course of the last few legislative sessions. The key thing for us is, you feel this from every public utility, we believe in local control. You know, we have a locally elected board responsive to the people of the county, and a fixed system methodology for being able to define how to address distributed generation does not work statewide. And I'll just give you an example. So in Chelan County, because we generate all of our power here, in fact, way more than we need to serve here, there is not a change in transmission costs when you either add or subtract load inside our county, because we're basically just going to pull power in from Rocky Reach, Rock Island, or Lake Chelan to serve us, whereas most people import their power. So there is a significant change in transmission costs as you change your load around, whether it's conservation or electric vehicles or distributed generation. So there is a reason why local control makes sense, because you can actually define a methodology that creates the right amount of value for your ratepayers. And so we tend to be uncomfortable with anything that tries to establish a statewide methodology and then applies it to Chelan County. Make sense? Hopefully. State auditor issues. So we've had a number of issues over the course of the last couple of years. I'm going to bring two to your attention. You may recall that there has been an issue around what are called unit price contracts. So today, or actually historically, what the utilities have been able to do is sign one contract, and then you'll be able to bring a contractor in for things like tree trimming or asphalt paving, things where you know you're going to have work throughout the year, but you may not know exactly where that work's going to occur. The state auditor has said, well, they're not trying to opine on whether it's a good practice or not, but they don't believe state law allows us to be able to do unit contracting. And the alternative to that is you have to define each job and then go contract for it, which is not a particularly efficient way of doing things. And we've appealed to the state auditor and said, well, wait a second, it seems like a fundamental function for you is to help government run as efficiently as possible. And it feels like this is pushing us in the opposite direction. And they say, yes, but it's also our job to make sure that you follow state law. We've been able to work that out, kind of, over the course of the last couple of years. It's baling wire and bubble gum, and but we're in a place where we're not, the state auditor is not finding us to be out of compliance with the law. There is a good chance that many of the utilities across the state are going to bring forward a fix, though, to that that will show up in this legislative session, and we are part of that group that is putting that together, and will be very supportive of trying to make sure that we get that kind of clarity. As you know, there has been a leadership challenge in the state auditor's office over the course of the last couple of years. And so we've seen some proposals come out of them that have been worrisome to us, but we're not sure what will happen when you actually get a new state auditor in. But I would just put on your screen that one of those issues has been that we get a state audit, so the auditors come in and do an audit of the PUD, but we use generally accepted accounting principles for the primary part of our work, and we have to, because we sell, today we don't, we're revenue financing a lot of work, but we have a lot of bonds, close to $500 million worth of bonds out there. At some point, the PUD will be back in the bond market, out in the future someplace, and you have to have GAAP standard accounting in order to be able to be successful in the bond market. So there have been proposals to use the government standards, GAGP standards, for us, and that the state auditor would manage that process for us. I'm just going to say it's a completely unacceptable outcome to us. We can't operate that way. So just put it on your screen again. I would not say that my hair is on fire today, but there's a match out there that's somewhere, and we're just watching to see if this if there's new leadership makes this issue go away. If it doesn't, then we would be in saying that we just can't work with this.
Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but the practice of unit price contracts has been a long-standing practice, generally viewed by prior auditors as an okay process.
Yes, actually, it was endorsed and supported.
So this is a change. I mean, it's been going on for literally decades, and so just one administration viewed it differently. So hopefully that change will happen.
Any questions on those? Retail Telecom Authority. So this is another one that's been a big issue in the last few legislative sessions. There have been proposals out there to provide retail authority for the PUDs to offer broadband services. Our issue is more limited than that. Fundamental concern for us is, I think you know, that 98% of our revenues come from one local supplier, and we're prohibited by law from being able to sell at retail. If for whatever reason some disaster were to occur and that supplier were to go out of business, we would be in really big trouble, and our customers would be in really big trouble because we'd have no way to provide service to them. So what we have proposed is a safe harbor provision where if there was a lack of a retail supplier, that we would have the ability to supply at retail. It's a risk mitigation tool. Again, there's no reason to believe that we're on the verge of having that happen, but on the other hand, you may not know with enough time, if it were to happen, to be able to get legislation that would allow you to fix the problem. So we very much in favor of trying to find some way to get to safe harbor. An issue that frequently is associated with the safe harbor or retail telecom provision is pole attachments. This has been around for many, many years. It's the whole question of who can attach onto poles and where do they attach. When we committed to the board directed us to go back into the fiber expansion business as part of the public power benefit program in 2015, we ended up doing a fair amount of work saying, well, let's make sure we understand where we're attaching fiber to our poles and is there room. There is a new National Electric Safety Code that has come out in the last year, and there are also state labor standards that describe how you will attach wire to pole and do so in a way because you're in an energized area that you're not creating a safety risk. That turned out to be very difficult to work through. It took us months, actually. It might sound like an easy thing, but it took us months to work through the where can we attach onto these poles and not create a risk. And we've also discovered that we have some challenges in terms of making sure that in some places we may have to put in bigger poles than what we have. And if you look around as you drive around, you'll see there's a lot of wire attached to the poles. And there's just a lot of stuff up there. So we actually have now are in the process of hiring a new pole attachment manager to try to manage through all these issues and to think through how we are going to do pole attachment. I will tell you that one thing that has become clear to me in this work is that one size fits all will not work. There are substantial differences just in between the utilities and the types of distribution systems that they have. So we are not supportive of changes to the current law. We believe we can make the current law work. There are some out there who believe that the current law may not work. We believe the current law can work, and we're comfortable with it as is. Fire liability. I don't know if you've heard about this, but there is one public utility in the state that has already had a problem with a danger tree that was off their right-of-way that fell into their line that created a fire, and they have been assessed liability for not managing for that problem. Well, if it's off your right-of-way, you don't have the ability to control to walk in and just take down a tree, particularly if it's on DNR land, as this one was. So there's a really significant concern here about how can I manage this risk? There's no way really to manage it, then if I can't manage it, why would the utility be responsible for it? So I would expect we're working with other utilities in the state looking at this whole fire liability question and trying to find some solutions. We expect there's a good chance we will be bringing something. We have not come to agreement yet as to how best to address it, other than, first of all, just to make sure that there is awareness that this is a problem, that because of some of the actions that have been taken, it is now clear that the problem is going to have to be addressed because some precedent has been set. Back billing. There was legislation in the last legislative session that would limit back billing. Apparently, the IOUs under UTC regulation have 6 months limits on back billing. This has not been a problem here. We haven't had complaints or concerns about back billing. We actually assess each situation and then decide how far to go back in terms of back billing. Some situations, there may have been a contribution from the customer that creates a reason why you might want to go back further than 6 months. In other situations, there isn't. It's just an area that we don't see a need for legislation. The board is able to manage the problem, and we haven't had complaints or issues that cause us to think that there's a need for a legislative resolution. Hydraulic project approval fees. So this is basically work that occurs in river that where you need a permit that we can be charged for. It's $150 per project now. There's proposals to increase it. We're not necessarily opposed to that, but we do have concerns about where it might go and how it might get worked out. You may recall that we spent a fair amount of time on hydro relicensing in the last legislative session, and we were able to work something out that we're okay with in terms of working with the state agencies on getting a fair compensation to them for the work that they do. We plan to approach this in the same way, but it's an issue that appears that it's coming. And then aquatic invasive species, the mussels, zebra and quagga, that are out there and are trying to come across our borders. And there is a state program out there now that helps to make sure that we keep those really bad things out of our system, and we're very supportive of trying to make sure that there's adequate funding for that program. So that's our top 10. You can see there's a lot of things that we might be wandering in and talking to you about during the course of the year. Any questions or comments about any of that? I'm going to ask Sean and Tracy, is there something that felt like you'd like to add to that description?
From my standpoint, you covered the issues quite well. I think these issues are going to develop daily as we start into the session, and some of these things we're going to have more information. We'll be coming back to the board and then as well to the delegation.
The one thing I would like to emphasize, Steve did touch on it, is we're spending a lot of time with some key associations on these carbon issues because we are not the only utility, and you're going to be tapped a number of times, I'm sure, other folks coming in. We're trying to work as much as we can and coordinate, especially on the carbon issue, with the public generating pool, as well as the Washington PUD Association. So we're spending a lot of time not only in this forum, but with our peers and other groups to work through these issues that are quite complicated.
Questions, comments, thoughts? Can we have it all?
Well, I appreciate your thorough review on all of this, and I know I've had the opportunity to talk to both Tracy and you, Steve, about some of these just before, you know, during the campaign, and it's nice to have some additional insight to all of these things. Just for one point of clarification, on the grant request, you said that was $1.5 million?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was, just from a historical standpoint, the Public Works Trust Fund, you are probably aware, mm-hmm. The fate of it the last couple of years.
Yep.
The money's been swept into the general fund.
Now, do you interact at all with MATCA?
Yeah, basically, there's no, we understand there's really, that's over-allocated, and there's no fund. So the Centennial Fund, the 1.5 we're talking about, is actually through Department of Ecology. And I believe there's, I think, $8 million is what they're anticipating, but only a small percentage that goes to this type of project. And we've been in line, I think we're number two or number three in priority for funding. So we're well positioned for that if there's adequate funding allocated to that fund through the budget process.
Maybe Carrie or Brad know more about this, but the recent litigation around the environmental suit that we won money from.
Yeah, Volkswagen is going to provide us $103 million at the federal level for the state and another $42 million at the state level. So there's about $150 million floating around out there. What we haven't seen yet is the specific parameters of how it can be used, and that's coming shortly. And of course, every group over there has got their eyes on this now and are looking to see what those parameters are going to be, and we're looking at some ideas. I actually have been working with Climate Solutions. I got to know these guys. And because I'm an electric car fan, I'm one of the few Republicans that have been willing to sit down and really work with them. And I've actually found them to be pretty reasonable when if you take the time to really work it out. So I am going to be directly in contact. You've been in my office twice during committee week talking about a couple projects, but they're the one that brought this money to my knowledge and are waiting to see exactly what the parameters of use are going to be around this money and when it's going to show up. But it should be in this cycle. And it could be far-ranging, but it could be used for a lot of different things as far as I can tell. So there will be some extra cash there, too. But whether that would be towards this, I'm not sure.
It doesn't look to us like it would go towards the Centennial Grant activity.
Yeah.
But I will say that it fits really well. This is where our principles help us, with respect to greenhouse gas emissions, because it does fit very clearly there. So maybe I'll just take a second and say, again, it's really clear that if you're going to hit 2050 targets, you have to do more with electrification, mm-hmm. and particularly the transportation sector. Where we draw a line is we are quite willing to do all the stuff that we would normally do as an electric utility. So electric charging stations, the things where you're getting power to a point, we're comfortable with doing, and then selling power, obviously, that's what we do. Where we get uncomfortable is when folks ask us to do things on the other side of the meter, because that's not been our job. That's not our role, is to go in. Right. So there have been proposals to spend money to help people put the charging equipment inside their garage.
Yeah, no.
Maybe if there's funding for something, then maybe that could happen, but it shouldn't be the utility that's responsible for that.
No, we agree. Right. It seems to me that they have changed their focus a bit and backed off of wind and solar a little bit. I mean, it's pretty obvious that we're a fairly carbon-free producer. And they've really turned their focus to transportation, to not only at the automobile level, but at the multimodal, at all the different transit levels, from buses to trains to everything. And it seems like their focus has shifted quite a bit. And the car electrification program seems to be kind of their top program right now. And I think that's good, because that moves a little bit away from where they've been before. And I think it's the most productive, when you talk about the most productive ways to reduce carbon, obviously transportation is a big part of it.
Yeah, and when we've run the numbers based on the currently available federal subsidies and state subsidies, electric vehicles is one of the least cost paths for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So it makes sense from a societal perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, from a utility perspective, it looks to us like the opposite of conservation. So we have, you know, we're heavily invested in making investments in conservation because it reduces load, saves all ratepayers money. Adding load, which right. is what electric vehicles are, does looks like really the opposite of conservation. So that's been our concern is, well, wait a second, it's going to be very hard for us to say we support the conservation programs if we were being asked to subsidize the vehicle electrification at the same time. The logic just doesn't connect there. So this is where we say we're happy to do what an electric utility would do, you know, get power to people, fine, do that. But if it's providing incentives to create this movement away from fossil fuel use, then that's really a societal job. And then we'd look to you guys and say, if society wants to do that, that's fine. We're happy to support it up to the point where it would create an allocation of cost between our customers where one's winning and one's losing.
Have you done any studies forward in terms of, I don't know how you would determine this, whether the market share of electric vehicles and at what level that creates what need, what load? In other words, what is the possibility, say, if you go to 5% or 10% or 15% electric vehicles, what does that do to the load picture?
We haven't done it for Chelan County, but the work has been done by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and it's a surprisingly small amount of load.
Really?
Yeah, actually, electric vehicles, there's a lot of them for sure, but when you think about it in the context of the load for the region, it's manageable in the sense of if you were adding that amount of load. Let me back up for a second. So loads in the region are generally flat. They have been for the last few years. We haven't been adding a lot of load. If you went back to where we were a few years ago, if you were adding electric vehicles, even an aggressive approach to electric vehicles, it would be a smaller amount of load addition than what we used to add annually from a regional perspective.
Wow.
So utilities could manage this. It's not an impossible task. It's just that when you're adding resources, it adds costs. And
sure.
So you have to manage that there will be rate increases associated with that.
And I'm sure there'll be more technological improvements in terms of efficiencies of these vehicles.
Yeah, Kerry, it might be worth checking out. Larry Weiss spoke at that as a power speaker at our last state association meeting. And I think there was a correlation between the amount of load it would take to utilize a common hairdryer and your commute to work. You know, so there's I can't remember exactly what the ratio in there is, but it's not too dissimilar. You know, and so, you know, we're talking about not necessarily increasing a huge load.
Wow.
So, but anyway, and he's always good to talk with anyway, so it'd be
good. Brad.
So, just on the state auditor's office, since we have a newly elected state auditor, is this coalition of utilities planning on seeing how the state auditor plans to interpret that or moving at a parallel path and also pursuing the statutory change?
So we're putting ourselves in a position to be ready with legislation, but certainly our first task will be to get in and say, is the policy about to change now that there's new leadership here? Because no need to pursue something if the policy is going to change.
There is but Steve is correct. We're still being poised to introduce something, and there's still actually there's something to the code revisor's office, but it hasn't been introduced. They don't have sponsors yet, so I think Waputa, who's helping us on that, is like and others will likely be following this path.
And just the reason I ask is because the policy could change with the subsequent state auditor. So maybe you know the timing's right. Maybe. There's opportunity to do that and just take it off the new state auditor's plate.
You guys have been around this process for a while. You know that you don't just write legislation overnight. We've been at this for almost a year now, just trying to get agreement about what it would look like. So there is some momentum just in terms of trying. We're getting close, we think, to getting agreement on what a fix would look like.
And are you working on the fire liability bill as well? Is that coming together?
We are. We're not as far along on that. Honest, the state auditor office issue has been around for longer, and so there's been more time to gain agreement around it. But we we are trying to figure out what a good approach is. Legislation is always hard. You think you've got the fix and it seems really simple, and then you walk through the 25 different scenarios of what might occur and you realize your fix doesn't work in a bunch of them. And we've run into that with the fire liability issue.
We never have that problem.
Just an additional comment on the poll attachments, and I saw your response, Carrie. You've been around long enough.
This has been going on forever. I don't think there's been a year I haven't seen some sort of poll attachment.
That is correct. I think you're absolutely correct. But the real push that's raising this is coming from the private sector that crosses through a variety of PUD-run counties. And so there's different needs out there, I guess, that aren't being met. And privates would like nothing more than to have a one-size-fits-all that they can go county to county to county on for telecom.
Now, well, I assume when you say private, because there's two different scenarios here in this town, that it would be like Charter or these private companies, because yeah. Local actually uses your own product, so
right,
they're
right,
not
right.
In that mix.
Yeah, we don't have a problem.
Okay,
yeah.
But Charter and these others and Frontier and whoever else is where the issue comes from, so we don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah, although generally we're not having big disagreements with them here in this county
in this
right
area.
Now. Right. It's really more of there's a big statewide issue going on. And when you come in and talk about telecom, like our safe harbor legislation, then poll attachments tends to come up. So and they get connected.
Likely that I think you may have seen the Pacific County PUD court case has recently made it out of the local courts in favor of Pacific County. So with Comcast, may want to see some action just to respond to that court case too. So these things keep adding to the likelihood of seeing something this year.
Okay.
Okay. Other thoughts or comments?
You know, just as I'm thinking about it on this electrification question, it's another good example of why it makes sense to, if there is going to be benefits flowing from ratepayers to pay for some of this. There are some utilities in the state who believe that their ratepayers would benefit from investments on the other side of the meter, whereas we don't see that happening here. So this is, again, the argument for local control. If it makes sense in some places, they should have the authority to be able to do so. If it doesn't make so here, we shouldn't be forced to do so.
Right. Agree.
Yeah. Well, we're going to... You probably won't hear most of these in at length tomorrow, but
yeah, I think the one that's missing are kind of startling that there's no I-937 anywhere on this chart, even though I see you mentioned it for 2020 forward. But there has always been concern with, you know, upping the standard, changing the standard. And is that just off the table till 2020 now, or is that what you feel like?
I think really this is where we tried to come up with all of those set of issues that Sean mentioned earlier with a set of principles. So with respect to 937, we would look at it and say we really don't see value in adding or increasing a renewable portfolio standard here when 100% of our power is hydropower.
Yes, we know that. That's always been the point, I think.
Right. But we're trying to work with our colleagues around a set of proposals looking at, well, how would you structure policy that would create least cost per meeting load and least cost per meeting greenhouse gas emissions? There may be some times in which it would make sense to do renewables, but an across-the-board renewable portfolio standard expansion is probably not going to be, that one seems fairly clear, is not likely going to be one that will meet both of those tests. So it all depends on the specifics, right? And so you look at proposals and you say, well, what is it that helps you achieve least cost for load and for greenhouse gas emissions reductions?
So you'd like to say we're moving into a post-937 era.
We hope.
We hope, yes. Yeah?
And one of the things I would like to add on that is, Steve mentioned this was a high-level initial study. There's more information that's needed in getting more people to provide perspective and contribute to that planning. That's that next level of detail that we need to identify. When do those resources need to come on? What are the resources that are needed? What conservation targets are going to be met? That's that next level of information, more work that needs to happen before we can get into saying this is when we need resource A, B, or C. So that's the more work that's coming.
Anything further for us?
Well, if I may just touch one more thing on the aquatic invasive species, it's one of the things that happened recently, if you hadn't heard, is that the detection of invasive mussel larvae, they didn't determine if they were zebra or quagga, but they were in eastern Montana, other side of the divide. But Montana was one of the states that hadn't had any detections previously, and all of a sudden now we have a detection in Montana. So timing for this bill could be very important for the state.
All right. And do you see that as an addition to the existing program or just a continuation of what we're doing?
They're asking for an addition to the current funding is about $800,000, and I think the full program over the course of years would ramp up to about a little over $4 to $5 million for the complete program. There's a ramping period with that.
All right. Anything additional? Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Glad we did this, and I guess we'll see you again tomorrow.
Yeah. And after round that, two. We'll see you next year, too.
Yeah.
In Olympia.
Yeah, make sure you give us the cocktail hour location. You know. The most important thing. All right.
So, is there any other business to come before us? If not, we'll stand adjourned.
Thank you.